Hello, and welcome to I Am the Egg Pod, hosted by me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I'm joined by singer-songwriter, musician, and a man who taught a whole generation the word pusillanimous. Hang on. How does it go again?
Pusillanimous.
Thank you. Neil Innes.
Hello, Chris.
Hi, Neil.
Hello, Egg Podders.
In this episode, we're celebrating the 50th anniversary of Abbey Road. Firstly, I want to thank Thomas McConnell, who's a musician from Liverpool who studies at Abbey Road Institute, who's arranged for this podcast to be recorded in Abbey Road. So, cheers, Tom.
Yes. through the miracle of radio, we are actually in the actual Abbey Road.
In the actual.
But being radio, we can't prove it.
Do you remember the last time you were in Abbey Road? Or?
Well, it was many, many moons ago. But it's completely changed. It's got a bit modern and more hard-edged inside. But you used to come up through the front steps, and there was a hallway, and then down some steps. And I think you got into the big studio down from the bottom, as well as coming in from the control room ladder. And we, the Bonzos, this is where we first made our first recording, were in more or less where we're sitting now, the studio on the left of the door you went in. And because, I don't know, do you want me to ramble?
Yes.
I couldn't believe it because our song that the Bonzos, because they got it all from old 78 records, you know, and this one was called My Brother Makes the Noises for the Talkies. Mm. And we had to, you know, make all these sound effects and things like that ourselves because you couldn't just buy records of sound effects. And so there were all these kind of scratchings and honkings and things going on. And I felt the call of nature. So I went outside to go to the loo. And when I came back, as I said, you know, the steps up from the outside go along a kind of landing. And then there were steps down again, and the loos were down there. And I was coming up the steps. So I was, my head was floor height,
right,
if you like. It's, I'm painting a picture for you here, listener. So my head was at floor height, you see, and all of a sudden these four guys, you know, with distinctive haircuts, tight trousers and pointy shoes, and dark glasses and two big minders, appear in the doorway, so rather dramatically silhouetted by the sunlight of the street outside. It was a sunny day, much as it is today. All right. But anyway, I thought, it certainly could be, of course. They record here too, don't they? So I was a bit curious, and once we finished off our record, I snuck out again, and I listened outside the door, and that's when they were doing George's I Want to Tell You.
Yes.
And somebody was pounding the grand piano with the F over the E. And it was... Years later, I was in George's kitchen, and I was telling him this very story, you know. And he went, oh, yeah. And just outside the kitchen, there's a piano. And I started playing it, and he picked up a guitar, and immediately did that lick. Do-do-do-do, do-do-do-do-do-do. And he obviously, you know, it's spontaneous.
Yeah.
So I'm amazing that, you know. It would take me, I'd have to sort of check out what I did, you know.
Yeah, after all those years, but he's
after
still
all those years, he knew it straight away. Yeah.
Wow. So that was 66.
Was it?
Yeah. But you kept in touch, obviously, after that, because obviously, following you, you're in Magical Mystery Tour.
Was it? Oh, all right.
Well, Death Cab for Cutie with the Bonzos.
Yeah, yeah,
but
that was on the first album, Gorilla.
Yes.
But I thought that was a bit later, but I suppose it wasn't. You see, I'm no good at Chris.
That's
I'm
right.
No good at names, dates, recipes, pet care.
You're good on the ukulele, though.
I'm not.
So thank you. You very kindly joined me on your day off from your Ruttles tour.
Yeah,
which is literally two dates in, I believe, at the moment.
Yeah.
So
how's that? 19 to go.
How's it been so far after this?
Well, you know, the hard thing is, you know, it rehearsals. You know, you've had to run it all through again. And you can probably hear me sounding a bit croaky. Because but you're 3 days of rehearsal, you really sort of start. You don't mean to use your voice, but you do.
Yeah.
You get carried away. So I'm having a bit of a hard time. But this day off, you know, be good. So tomorrow and the day after, and another day off, and you know, you need to strengthen up your voice.
Yeah.
And at the moment, we're on the Russells this year, we're joined by Dave Catlin Birch, and I've worked with him before. He toured with the Bonzos, believe it or not, when we did it in 2006. So it's just lovely to have him. But he's a real professional, you know, because you can hear he warms up and he's always exercising his voice.
Oh, okay.
I should do that, but I don't.
There's a quote from David Quantick. He was saying there's more love for the Beatles at a Ruttles gig than there is at a Paul McCartney Stadium gig. Do you pick that up? I'm hoping you do.
Well, I can't compare because I don't get out much, you know, people. There's definitely, I mean, yeah, the somebody in Glasgow summed it up, I thought, really nicely by saying, I've never been in a room so full of happy people.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, well, this can't be bad. You know, it's not a career move. You know, we love doing it. So we go out, you know, once a year and try not to lose money. Have fun, try not to lose money. Because it does cost money. You have to have a splitter van, you have to have hotels, you have to have a sound engineer, backline, all that kind of thing. But it is good fun.
Yeah.
You know, I sort of talk about, you know, the Ruttles because it's over 40 years now. And so the Ruttles started off as a good idea at the time. But whatever they've turned into, you know, they have absolutely no comfort zone in the music business, whatever.
Yeah.
So, I mean, don't bother to understand it. If it has, if it's fun, if it makes you happy, you know, that's what it's the most important thing.
Oh, it certainly does. There's a lot, there's so much love for the Ruttles. Doing all these podcasts, I'd say the Ruttles have been mentioned in every episode at some point.
Oh, right. Oh, well, it's lovely. Well, I was taken by surprise because I think, when was it, 94? I was invited to go to a Beatle Fest, as they were then known, in New Jersey.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, what do they want me there for? You know, he said, no, you know, you should come. And that was the first time in my life I sort of found out that Beatle fans actually picked up on what the Ruttles did, and they liked it, and they took it exactly the right way.
Mm.
And I spent the whole weekend signing Ruttle albums. And
talking of which, later on, if you could, that'd be...
Oh, right. You got a pen?
Yeah. The love for the Ruttles is so enduring, but it's weird because the film and the music have evolved into two kind of separate entities.
Yeah.
And I think, for me personally, and I know several people who are the same, I probably watch the film maybe once a year, but I'm always dipping into Ruttles songs pretty well as much as the Beatles. It's endured, the music has just endured for so long.
Well, I mean, I'm pleased, you know, because I didn't... No, at the time, you know, it was, for me, it was a one-off gag in Rutland Weekend Television. My job was to come up with musical things on a shoestring, and Eric was writing sort of shoestring sketches and other things. The studio we had in Television Centre was called Presentation B, which is just across the corridor from Presentation A, where they do the weather forecast.
Okay.
So you can imagine, it was a bit tight in there. We had the entire court of Queen Elizabeth I in there one day. But, you know, I just thought to myself, well, we could do a parody of A Hard Day's Night. Because Dick Lester, as Eric points out, which isn't far from Rutland, directed, you know, Hard Day's Night. And it was like Benny Hill, you know, black and white, speeded up bits and whatever. So that's pretty cheap. So four guys in wigs and tight trousers and pointy shoes running around a field, you know, it's got to be sort of on the lower scale of budgeting.
Yeah.
So we did, and I told him this, and he said, "Oh, good, because I've got this idea for a documentary maker who's so boring the camera runs away from him." You know, yeah. So we put those two things together, and we used to work. You know, he of all the Pythons, he wrote on his own.
Yes.
I was obviously right. So yeah. We'd meet up every now and again. We'd sort of say, well, and put items down on a postcard and put them on a notice board so we could all, we could both look at where things were. And that's how we built the each episode. And sort of, you know, it's a very good way of working.
Yeah. You know? Well, he's never really collaborated at all, has he, with Python? Obviously.
No.
So for you, it must be quite...
Well, it we were separate ways. You know, he enticed me into doing it by saying, you know, he said we're at Drury Lane, and he said, "Do you fancy doing some television?" And I said, "Well, you know, I've never really liked television that much, Eric." You know, he said, "Why?" I said, "Well, the camera never points where you want to put it." You know, this is my experience of being with the Bonzos, doing "Do Not Adjust Your Set."
Yes.
You know, when he was on that as well, was how we first met. And of course, with the Bonzos, they never did anything the same twice.
No.
Of course, the camera just didn't know where to point.
No.
You know, but when Eric said the magic words, "Well, you can tell the camera where to point," I went, "Ooh, hello, that's different."
Yeah.
And so, yeah. So I mean, I was responsible for the music bits and how and the idea. You had to come up with a way of visualizing the music bits. So that's how my role was. And so I was working on my own. He was working on their own. And we came together and put the stuff on the notice board. And that's how tapping the table and sending postcards came into being. Oh, it's happening in the village road.
There was a bit of a Beatlesy pastiche on Python's matching tie and handkerchief for the medieval agrarian history sketch, and you're doing the "It's written in the village rolls."
Yeah,
and there's a bit at the end that's very like it's got "Hey Jude" feel. It's "Well, the village and the ploughman's got to have the Lord's consent."
Yeah, that's right. Yes,
and so there's always a hint of Beatley.
Well, this is the dull thing, you know, because "Do Not Adjust Your Set" was going. And I hadn't met John Cleese or Graham, but they used to stop writing. You know, we were doing on the 1948 show around the same, and they used to rush home to watch this kids program. You know, so when that all packed up and the Bonzos, you know, decided to have a lie down, you know, the phone went and it was Eric, and he said, "Oh, no, what are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm doing a bit of recording, a bit of producing, this and that." He said, "Do you fancy coming up to the television centre? Our warm-up man is ill."
Oh.
I said, "I don't do warm-ups." He said, "It's 25 quid." I said, "All right, done."
That was it.
But yeah. Well, so I went up there, and afterwards we went out for a meal, and it turned out that they were thinking of doing some albums, and they wanted to do some songs, and they wanted if I'd help out. And I said, "Well, what sort of songs have you written?" And Eric said, "Well, Michael's written this thing about agrarian reform." I went, "Oh, yeah."
Off you go.
I'll get Detroit worried, you know. But and John, who's very sort of like to the point, said, "And what sort of music do you think for that, Neil?"
Ooh.
And that's when I went, "Reggae?"
Obviously, yeah.
But, you know, again, talk about luck. You know, I mean, it's lucky being in the Bonzos, you know, because that was fantastic. Yeah. That was the most daft time of anyone's life. But then to sort of like that sort of, you know, withers on the vine after 5 years, you know, no holidays and three managers.
Yeah.
But yes. To suddenly, you know, rub shoulders with Eric and Mike and Terry and Terry Gilliam, on the children to then sort of dovetail into Python. You know, you don't sort of plan this career. I don't think I've got an ambitious cell in my body, but I've been incredibly lucky. You know, in terms of you know, drifting in from one thing to another.
Saturday Night Live really pushed that into another
It, because this is where, you know, life happens when you're busy making other plans. Was it Sid Bernstein?
Yes.
The promoter, he was trying to get the Fabs back together again and offering them $20 million each or something and a killer whale as a pet. And so Saturday Night Live were running with the gag, you know, about getting the Beatles back together because everyone was heartbroken. I mean, this is the thing, you know. I mean, this is not any old guitar-driven combo. This, you know, they gave a spark to everybody. And all of a sudden this spark looked as it wasn't going to be there. So heartbroken people everywhere. So big story, you know. Get the Beatles back together again. And Lorne Michaels, the producer of Saturday Night Live, got George to come on Saturday Night Live.
Yes.
And stood with a wad of dollars, you know, $3,000, which is the musicians' union fee for four live musicians in the studio.
Right.
And he's saying, you are George. All this can be yours, George. You know, so. And George is acting, going, "What? All of this for me?" and Lorne sort of snatches it back and said, "You know, well, no, you've got to share it with the others. Maybe you don't have to tell Ringo." These jokes, you know, were going on, and so it just naturally followed that you know they got Eric to host the show. They always had a host. It could be Paul Simon.
Yes,
you know, I mean, this was like tentacles to everybody who was everybody at the time, Saturday Night Live. So, but Lorne, you know, said, well, we got Eric Idle, you know, to sort of playing it down a bit, you know, because he said he could get the Beatles for $300, you know, and so they spun it along like this for ages until they said, well, finally, you know, we were getting concerned. We phoned Eric and we said, and he said, sure, sure, everything's fine, everything's fine. Anyway, it turned out to be a bad phone line. He hasn't got the Beatles, he's got the Ruttles.
Oh, okay.
And they showed the clip from Rutland Weekend Television on Saturday Night Live. And you just could not anticipate it, but they had bags and bags of mail of people who wanted to bring their toys to the same sandpit and play at this, you know, the Ruttles were the Beatles getting back together again, you know. You couldn't predict it. And so it took Lorne 20 minutes to go downstairs and get the budget for the Ruttles, All You Need Is Cash. The story of the Prefab Four.
Absolutely.
You know, just, but, I mean, everybody making it just knew what to do because, you know, the story was the story of the Beatles. And, and for us, we just pretend the Beatles didn't exist and the Ruttles were what it was. And it was like being a child again, playing Cowboys and Indians or something, you know. So but I remember the meeting up in NBC thing in New York, and they're all getting excited. Oh, we can do the whole story and everything like that. And I was sort of nonchalantly sat on a windowsill waiting because, you know, I knew that if they're going to do the whole story, they're going to need more songs.
Yes.
I was kind of bricking it,
yeah,
to be honest, you know. And finally, they suddenly went, ah, we're going to need some more songs. Oh, Neil, can you do 20 more Ruttle songs by Thursday lunchtime? You know. I said, I'll try. And I knew that if I'd listened to any Beatles songs, I would have been sunk, you know?
This is the weird thing. I've heard you say this before. How do you... You compose the songs more from your memory rather than listening to all the songs, and it was kind of your version of your memory of the songs.
I thought, that's a way for me to work. Where was I when that happened. And I don't know, it triggered a kind of parallel thing, and what that did, and I don't know, because the first album had to have the kind of signposts to tell the story, you know. So All You Need Is Love had to become Love Life, you know. Yeah. And some of the, you know, the others, like Piggy in the Middle, I Am the Waitress, you know, W.C. Fields Forever, yeah. You know. But I had to get a system where if I got the lyrics and I got the tune, it had to work with just one instrument, like a guitar or a piano. And and if I could sing the song with one instrument, I knew the song worked structurally. Yes. But then, you see, it wasn't until we got in the studio, actually, and we'd rehearsed them, the four of us. It was Ricky on bass, Ollie Halsall on guitar, John Halsey on drums, me, you know, guitar and piano.
Did you know them before? Obviously,
I knew Ollie and John,
right?
And Ricky, Eric met Ricky on a beach in Bermuda.
Oh, right.
No, he literally was on holiday. His girlfriend was Penelope Tree at the time. Ricky remembers it and said, Eric just said to me, Ricky, do you fancy being a ruttle? And he said, I remember the thing at the time. So I didn't know what a ruttle was. So I said, okay. I mean, he's stupidly laid back. Yeah. You know, I mean, but yeah, no, he was, he and his brothers, the Flames, were the first band that the Beach Boys signed up. And Ricky then went on to, after Dennis, you know, fell off the boat, Ricky then became the Beach Boys drummer. Yeah. And he is an amazing drummer. As Halsey points out, you know, the Ruttles are really two drummers and a rhythm guitarist.
It's like Adam and the Ants.
Yes. We rehearsed, and we with a guy called Alistair and two track machines, two Revoxes, and it got pretty tight. 2 weeks we were there, and Wimbledon was on, so we had a fancy break. We watch a bit of, you know, and then we get back to playing rock and roll.
Yeah,
and we came out and we knew the songs. We went in. And it's only when we started recording that we started listening to the production of you know, Fifth Beatle, George Martin, in this place, you know, and some of the shenanigans they got up to, you know. And they thought, that's got that on it, you know. Because remember, we were doing the whole thing from early days to later days, you know. Yeah. So it was a crash course in what they'd invented. I mean, you could argue that they are kind of, in a way, responsible for prog rock.
Well, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean,
from Abbey Road
onwards. As Eric, lovely expression, people got the wrong end of the stick and started to beat around the bush with it.
When you recorded it, the quality sounded too good.
Yeah.
So you had to really compress it.
Well, that's the other thing. I mean, I did say earlier, everybody involved with this project sort of was totally enthusiastic. And Steve James, who I didn't know until we turned up at Chapel Studio, but Steve's dad is Sid James. So I mean,
Sid
but
James.
That, yeah. So, wow. But so we kind of, you know, got on. He was, I think he was about 12, but he's a great engineer, and he thought, well, we got to do this, you know, and he ripped the tape through the machine, 2-inch. 24 track tape at 30 inches per second.
So it's going to be good quality.
That's the trouble. Yeah. It was too good.
Yeah.
And we thought, it's great, the playing's great, but it doesn't sound right. It sounds too good. And so then we put it through a compressor, and that squidged off some of the thing, but it ended up like it sounds. And that's the other thing. All the Beatle recordings have got this energy and this extra level in there. And we wanted to get that. And and I've just finished working with Steve again, actually.
How did you?
He moved to Australia, and I've just been out there recorded an album of new new songs with him, and I couldn't be more delighted, you know, with the playing and the song. It's Phi doesn't get any higher.
When can we hear this?
Oh, soon. I
do
hope.
Know there's been a few.
Well, it's kind of. I think we have to suffer the pain of whatever happened to Pledge Music, in order to get the following wind that we got with the musicians and people who are playing. There wasn't one bad vibe in the whole recording thing. So I'm looking upon it as a kind of miraculous jewel surrounded by horror, you know, because it is. And it's we're still not out of the woods, but it's mixed and mastered. I'm having a meeting tonight about the cover and the packaging. Okay. And everything's got, you know, because I haven't got the money.
Yeah.
I have not got the money that they gave to people gave to them to give to me. It sounds like a Laurel and Hardy sketch, but I've got. But I want to try and you know I've sent out t-shirts which we had in stock. I'll be doing the handwritten lyrics that people wanted.
Yes.
But we won't be doing the vinyl straight away because we've got to get the money back that we spent on the studio and recording.
Right.
And what have you. So we're going to have to sell some of the CDs in order to afford to give away the free ones if people can't get their money back. Some have contributed again. It's a, well, what's it a parallel with? Brexit.
Yeah. Okay. Then. Right. You
know,
I am the
Eggpod. If anyone knows what's going on, they're lying.
Yeah.
You know.
I am the Eggpod. Is right. Have you got a Patreon account or is this?
No.
So I think we've got enough listeners that we can help Neil. I'm sure everybody listens to this.
Ah, well, there is a GoFundMe.
Right.
.com with the new Neil in his the new album. There's also a lovely bloke who. What are they called? The Untidy Crowd. They're trying to get a crowd to sing How Sweet to Be an Idiot. And they've got, you know, 400 or 500 followers. Yeah. So they're chipping in to GoFundMe and making a video. And Richard's doing all that.
Yeah.
And so we'll see how that's going. I couldn't be more bowled over. I mean, the support and love it's coming my way is sort of, well, it's gushy. I mean, I'm misting up. Sorry.
Someone get a tissue.
No, really. I mean, it's...
No, it's true.
It's amazing. But all the more reason, you know, to get this out and do it right and try and get rid of the nasty world that it's becoming that made this happen. You know, it's like in 2008, all those, you know, toxic bankers. They should be in orange jumpsuits now. And, you know, you just... I don't know. Don't start me on. it's callous. And these, you know, people who don't know how the system works, but they know how to work the system.
Yeah.
And it's got to stop. Yeah. And you've got to have something else. That, you know, otherwise, you know, I mean, if they go ahead with Brexit, you know, it'll take so long the planet will destroy itself by then.
Absolutely.
You know, there's bigger things to do, and there's you know, and we do need love.
We do, and we need this album. So, everybody, listen to this. Please do help. We need to hear this. Talking of love life.
Yeah,
Noel Gallagher's been singing that recently.
I've
on
heard,
tour.
Yes, and he puts in "Love is the meaning of life."
Yeah,
life is the meaning of love.
Yeah. Your play on words. One of my favourite things is on Double Back Alley. Orally, it's soaked in that authentic 60s sort of Penny Lane sunshine. But I love, instead of suburban skies, an hourglass and a nurse selling poppies, you've got gin, bingo and saccharine Sally's drawers.
Yes.
And your wordplay is... And again, I was crying with laughter. I was listening to Hey Mister last night.
Oh, right,
and at the end, I've got blisters on my fingers. Your version's...
Yes.
It just appears.
Well, because you have to try and do them because they're there. It's a nod and a wink towards it.
Yeah.
But, you know, the double back alley thing, it's because of Penny Lane, and that's the one that really made me sit up when I heard Beatles music, and I thought, this is taking popular songwriting to a new level. It's like shooting a movie with little things. And yeah. Then I thought, shooting a movie. And I thought, double back alley popped in, and I got this image of like black and white Pathé pictorial films of kids playing in the war and things like that. And as I said, you know, I put myself into my own world to come up with a parallel song, and that's what, you know, and those images kind of fed me in Double Back Alley. It was like a black and white news reel, you know. And it's lovely, actually, because, I mean, George had a jukebox at home, and that one was always on it.
Yeah, really? Yeah. Oh, wow. Tell me about George. You were, of all the Beatles, I'm guessing, well, obviously you were closest to George. How did your friendship blossom?
Well, there actually is quite a simple answer to that. Gardening.
I was going to say it right in the script to be.
Well, so I'm married to the cleverest garden designer people. Yvonne, and when we moved out of London, we sort of got a bigger garden. She suddenly thought, "What are all these green things?" You know, she's a town girl, and then she sort of really got the bug and went around talking Latin and learning the genuses of this and that. And she got a job in a plant centre down the road. It happened to be a very good one. Blooms of Bressingham, you know, with real plantsmen who went around the world and got things.
Yeah.
And she was just putting out plants and things like that. And they suddenly realised she's got a flair for it, and they put her in charge of displaying things. And then, well, she ended up running the landscape department and doing a garden in Chelsea every year. And she's got over 12 gold medals.
Wow.
You know, so, yes, so George had a big garden.
It's huge. It was acres.
40
it?
Acres.
Wow.
But, you see, he bought Friar Park, and it was falling to bits, really. It was used by nuns in the war hospital, and it was built by a Victorian eccentric called Sir Frank Crisp.
Yes.
And he got a thing about friars. Friar Park, monks, you know, and you could see terracotta panels about 4 foot high on the side of this sort of like Victorian palace in a way. And there's two monks there with two frying pans with holes in, and he's got two holy friars. You know, and this is silly, you know. But over the mantelpiece, he's got ring out the old, ring in the new, ring out the false, ring in the true, beautiful marble. Sir Frank Crisp had an extraordinary mind, because he planned the rockery. There's a scale model of the Matterhorn. You know, literally, you walk up, it's as high as a house, average house.
Yeah.
And there's a topiary garden, the Japanese gardens where the waterfalls turn on and off. And George was, he said he was just fiddling about. Where the things, the waterfalls and the lakes are, and his foot went into a hole. He thought, "Hell, what's that?" And he investigated, and it was a bigger hole, and somebody had dropped a bike in there. They took the bike out, and underneath the Japanese garden is a grotto. You know, and so George is, you know, painstakingly restored all this. And one day, I'm sure it'll be open to the people, but you'd probably have to do it by, you know, organising an appointment, because if you just open the gates, well, you know, people run off with everything, you know.
Yeah.
Here's a bit of branch from George's garden, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's got to be done carefully, I think.
Yeah.
But it will happen, I'm sure.
You think? Oh,
but, you know, but there again, you know, this is where Yvonne and George and Olivia, you know, they all discuss the garden together, you know, we spend a lot of time down there.
Yeah.
So.
And the stories, he was glued to his ukulele.
He always carried two if he went out anywhere. Yeah, in case someone forgot theirs. But no, ukuleles are good friends. You know, yeah. I mean, you mustn't buy the, you know, you can get them anywhere, you know. They're yes. normally painted in bright colours, but they're not always going to be sort of instruments, no. as, you know, as ornaments, you know. Yeah. But if you you need to pay a good, a fair amount of money for a good ukulele.
Yes.
And my ukulele test is, if you want to play vibrato on it, it's a good one.
You know? Okay.
Because it'll just go... But it inverts normal guitar chords. In fact, can you pass my ukulele?
We have because Neil's ukulele here.
This is not... You know, this is literally by chance. I'm looking after it because I know they'll sit on it in the van if I'm not, if I'm not there. But this is a baritone ukulele. And you can put a lower string on it, so instead of going na da dee dee, this goes.
Ooh, interesting!
And that last one was an accident because I broke the top string.
Oh right!
It should have been an octave higher, and I grabbed something in a fit of pique.
So you
put
it
on
now.
There. Well, it does do another. Anyway, let me tune it. But if I remember this thing, but it's it just sends you in a different mood, you know, a different because you can play, you know, sort of
This is the point where I ask, can you play a song that always makes me cry, Old Age Becomes Me?
Oh.
But I might cry.
Oh, wow. Oh, I'm knocking the microphone. That's going to be on the new album, actually.
Is it?
I used to think I could think things through. Now any notion I fancy will do. My lifetime's false is divided by true. Old age becomes me. So many memories to recall. Good times, bad times began small. Now like New England after the fall, old age becomes me. The sycamores and willows stand tall down by the stream. My blanket is a jacaranda blue. Among my extra pillows I still know how to dream. Someday I'm gonna run away with you. A little different, this tuning. I know life is much more than my limited attention span. Now all I do is all I can. Old age becomes me. I'm along at home, why don't you? Across the universes where all of us must go. Sooner or later, by and by. Oh, but what is far, far worse is all those people in the know. Who claim they can explain the reasons why. I've had my fill of all the ballyhoo. Enough of soft shoe shufflers too. And as for the young and beautiful, well, you know what they can do. Old age becomes me. Could have done with a little practice.
Oh, lovely, lovely, lovely.
I wrote that from, yeah, it's not exactly a brand new song. I wrote it for my 65th.
Okay.
I thought, you know, that's the pension age. Actually, Tom McGuinness from Manfred Mann, yes. I've known for years. Anyway, he got me in touch with him. He said, why don't you come to these SODS lunches? Mm. SODS are Songwriters of Distinction.
Right.
And twice a year, okay. they have these lunches down in Barnes. And I said, well, what's something going on? He said, well, it's fun. You know, the other last time he said he was there, he said, I saw Adam Faith and Noddy Holder and Bruce Welch all in a huddle in the corner. So I went over and said, well, what are they talking about? You know, he went over and he found out they were talking about their winter fuel allowance.
Abbey Road, 50 years ago this year, 50th anniversary.
I know. You know, when they came out, you couldn't imagine 50 years in the future. No. You just couldn't. But now we just sort of, oh, it's 50 years since that. 40 years since that.
Yeah. Do you remember when that album came out and your feelings towards it?
Or? Well, the headline things, you know, because, I mean, like most people, you pick up on maybe three or four things out of the whole album. And that sort of, funnily enough, the ending sticks out for me, you know, because that's a lovely, you know, because I like words.
Yeah.
And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make. I mean, not a lot wrong with that, you know. And that, you know, that sort of sums it up, you know, in a way. But, I mean, I'm told... Let It Be was done before Abbey Road. So,
yeah.
I mean, it was obviously, you know, it was crumbling, you know, in terms of... But, I mean, what can you do? I mean, that's awful in a way, that, you know, because they couldn't play on stage because it was just getting ridiculous, security and whatnot. So they were forced into somewhere like this and to get inventive. And thank goodness they did get inventive.
Oh, yeah.
But it came at a price, and I think that was it. You know, you can't just keep creating in a vacuum.
Yeah.
So I mean, I think George was one of the first to sort of say, well, let's put the suits in the cupboard and move on. And that's why he was so keen on the Ruttles, you know, debunking things as well.
Yeah.
You know, come on, cheer up, you know. That's And it's funny because the Magical Mystery Tour, there was this instant rapport because the Bonzos were in a van going out and doing things, and the Beatles had been in a van going out doing things, and there's a definite camaraderie, you know.
Mm.
And so, you know, just everyone was kind of mates immediately, you know.
Because they always had that love for sort of left-field music. I mean, you saw the Bonzos...
Well, it's a bit of the old art student thing, you know. I mean, when I was at art school, you know, when the Bonzos were all at art school, we sort of, I particularly, you know, liked Dada because it came out of the First World War, which I was equally aghast and, you know, I couldn't understand how it could be so... industrialized and callous, you know, and how people did it, you know, but that had something that awful, you know, got people, you know, like Breton, who was a psychiatrist in the trenches, to sort of say, well, what is humanity doing? You know, this is 1916, and they start this anti-art movement, and they're sort of trying to question things and get people to adjust the way they think, but. It's, you know, it's doing things in the wind. It's, you know, it's when humanity gets the bits between its teeth to be completely stupid, it doesn't seem as though anything will stop it.
Yes.
You know, the Peloponnesian Wars, Plato, Socrates, you know, they're all saying, you know, there's another way. You know, and why? Why?
Yeah.
But that's why, you know, the Beatles, even in their crumbly bit, can I have a look at the... They're just great Beatle tracks, aren't they? I mean, come together. You know, it's not just an ordinary... There's a... You know, I mean, it's just inventive all the... And something... I really teased George one day walking around the park. I said, you know, you're half a lazy bugger, aren't you, when it comes to lyrics? He said, what do you mean? I said, well, you can't think of a rhyme, you just put a bloody guitar lick in. He said, yeah, but... Oh, no. You know? No, I mean, they're all fantastic. Well, Maxwell Silver Hammer. I liked it, actually. I thought, why not?
Yeah.
The Dark Supers, good old Ringo. I Want You. Yeah, I mean, it's all there. Polythene Pam, a bit like Saccharine Sally. Yes. They got it all from me, you know.
Yeah.
No, I mean, now it all comes back, just reading through the... I love that ending. Golden slumbers fill your eyes.
Yeah.
And then carry that weight in the end, you know. And then Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl.
Yeah. Kind of thrown in it. Yeah.
No, I mean, yeah, I think it's well worth, you know, digging it out and listening to it all again.
And Come Together, I think, could be a possible influence on Ina Kleiner middle class music.
Oh, certainly. There's all sorts. That kind of thing. But I mean, the other one as well, you know, doom, doom, doodle, doom. Mm. All of them, you know, it's a way of, you know, and that's why, you know, I think the word rustle really should be a verb. To copy or to emulate someone you admire, brackets, especially in the music business, because everybody ruffles everybody else. There's no two ways about it.
Like Come Together, it's quite a bluesy song, but lyrically, there's some horrendous imagery going.
Well, you know, it's. I said to Derek Taylor, who I also knew very, very well, I said, you know, it's amazing that the lads all went through all that without going completely crazy. He went, what do you mean? They did from time to time, you know, lose it, you know, as you would. I mean, this is unreal, you know, what they've been put through.
Yeah.
Going back to that spark, you know, if you don't feel that spark, you haven't got a life. And it's like... Mm.
That's right.
And if you haven't got a mobile phone...
Who is it? Should we speak to him?
It's Ken Thornton. Rattling Ken Thornton.
Oh.
Our guitarist. I'm not going to answer it, though. But that's him.
Wow.
And you could say you heard his phone on Eggpod. So he's given up.
No stamina, these guys.
He's a quitter. Something in the way she moves attracts me like no other lover. Something in the way she woos me. I don't want to leave her now. You know I believe in how.
I love something during the, obviously you were there as well, in the concert for George.
Mm.
And Paul did it on the ukulele.
Yeah.
That love for the song and for the man and for his favourite instrument as well. But what was that like for you?
Well, I mean, it was kind of very weird for me in a way, because I was sort of more or less with the Python wing of things, which meant I'm sort of in a brown coat playing the piano for the Lumberjacks and things like that, and then having to stand up on... It's persistent, isn't it?
Come on, Ken.
Ken? Go away. So, yeah, that's a lovely mood there, broken by technology. But the George's, you know, and when I'm standing there with the others, you know, with the waiter's long thing, and I, it was my idea, you know. for Hollywood Bowl. We're all sitting up in this pool on the roof at the L'Hermitage Hotel saying, well, how are we going to make Sit on My Face, you know? So, well, why don't you do it as glee, you know, waiters, you know, and then you can turn around and you've got no trousers on. That's a cheap laugh. And I never thought they'd... Yeah, I'm right, that's it. Okay. So that's what I found myself doing. And I thought, is this a way to remember a dear chum, you know, by burying your ass in the Albert Hall? And I thought, no, George, absolutely, would go for it.
But
it was magical. But four drummers? No, but it was fantastic.
Yes. Yeah. And Tom Hanks was there as well, wasn't
Tom,
he?
Tom, yeah, yeah. No, it was,
hidden away.
I said, you know, when we were ready to go out and we got no trousers on, I said, and he's dressed as a Mountie, and the camera came in and they said, let's compromise, Tom. So we went, hello, Tom, you know. No, he's a really good egg. George was a Mountie once in New York, yeah. He came out and did I'm a Lumberjack. And lots of people did. Harry Nilsson did, most memorably, because... Of all the Mounties, he'd got his buttons done up wrong.
Oh, right.
And when he took a bow, he didn't stop. He just went straight off the edge of the stage into the orchestra pit.
Really? I love
a warning there, listener. Go easy on the tequila.
Yes. Talking of possibly tequila, I love the story of Viv Stanchel in the bar with Paul McCartney at the speakeasy.
Yeah. Because that's how Paul got to do produce Urban Spaceman.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Bonzos were, you know, something out on recently that's showing that, you know, we were one of the highest paid bands in the country. We never had a hit record. Mm. And the record company said, well, why don't we do a single, you know, do a single. Said, well, why should we do a single? We don't have to do a single. You know, and anyway, they were leaning on us. And anyway, I came up with the idea of Urban Spaceman really quickly. We were in a hotel in Manchester, Oxford Road, looking over on a building site. And in those days, building sites were not, you know, today they're called brownfield sites, but in those days they were called urban spaces. Mm-hmm. And I just suddenly thought, well, oh, urban space, well, what about an urban space? But they were all this Cape Canaveral nonsense. Mm. So I dashed it off really quickly. And I played it to Viv, and he said, too many verses. I said, yes, you're right. And so we shortened it down. We thought, we've got a song. We'll put that forward. And Jerry Braun, our manager, was also our producer. He produced Gorilla. But he had this weird notion that nobody spent more than 3 hours recording a track. Huh?
Yeah.
So, I mean, even on Gorilla, we thought this is ludicrous, you know, because we wanted to play with the toys just like everyone else. And so we did this Dada track called... Jazz Delicious Hot Disgusting Cold. Yes. And I think arguably the best thing a Bonzos ever did in the studio. Because we said, whatever it is, it's one take.
Yeah.
And it'll take 15 minutes and we've got 2 hours and 3 quarters to sort of spend on it. And we just tapped it in and did it. And what you hear is what you hear.
That's it, yeah.
So we did that. Anyway, so he's the one that, you know, produces by saying you've got to finish in 3 hours. And Viv used to go down the speakeasy, and Paul used to go down there, and they used to hang out riffing like old English country squires. You know, so put another one there, right here, you know, and getting horribly drunk at the time. And and Viv was saying, oh, we've got to make this bloody single. Yeah. You know, I said, what's wrong with that, says Paul. You know, he said, well, it's got a noddle in it. You can't do something in more than 3 hours, you know. The trouble is we can't get the blighter off the knobs. So Paul says, well, I'll come and produce it.
Yeah.
Really? Yeah. You know, and good as his word, he turns up and, you know, we go and tell Jerry, you know, so we'll do the single then, but we don't want you to produce it.
Yeah.
And he walked right into it, you know. Oh, and who do you think you're going to get? Tumbleweed, Paws, you know, Paul McCartney.
Oh, man.
And, so Paul came in. And then because of this 3-hour timing thing, when Paul came in and said, I've just written this, And he went over to the grand piano and started playing Hey Jude. And he goes all the way through.
Really?
You know, I'm thinking, why is he playing this dirge? Oh, it's to waste all this time, you know. Not that dirge, but you know what I mean. It's you know, but first I thought, you know, you can't spend the studio just playing a song.
No.
Anyway, so he did that, and but pretty soon, you know, he had me singing it every time, so I really sung it in, and Larry was just going, chat, 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 and he said, yeah, we'll have that, and we did one like that, and he said, now half time the drums, don't bat, don't don't bat. Don't, you know, and this all of a sudden, you know, and he grabbed Viv's ukulele and went dinky 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 dink, just like Nashville, just lean into the microphone. Yeah. The man's a magic man. He's
so
a genius.
It was hands on production, it wasn't just the name Paul McCartney.
No, or no, Apollo. No, no. He was in the room, you know, being a thorough best. No, it was lovely. You know, and you know, and Jerry Bronson's wife, Lillian, bless. She never came to sessions usually, but because Paul was there, she thought she sort of ought to look in. And she was really a rather county lady, went to Oxford. And Paul is playing the ukulele. Viv's left-handed, and so is Paul. So he's not going to... And she goes, oh, what's that you've got there, a poor man's violin? And Paul immediately says, no, it's a rich man's ukulele. So 8 hours later, we're nearly ready to put it to bed.
Oh,
and
wow,
Viv said, do you know, I think I'd rather like to play my garden hose.
Oh, right.
Yes, and he had a length of garden hose with a trumpet mouthpiece in one end and a plastic funnel in the other. And Paul says, well, what's that do then? You know, and he said, well, here you are. And he blows in one end and whirls it round his head. You know, and the engineer says, you can't record that thing. So Paul says, yes, you can. Put a microphone in each corner. So that was another 20 minutes.
That's how you record. I'm the urban spaceman, baby. I've got speed. I've got everything I need. I'm the urban spaceman, baby. I can fly. I'm a supersonic guy.
And it was so cool because at the end, you know, Jerry's thinking, well, we've got something. And it's produced by Paul McCartney. Well, at that point, I think it just evolved. He said, well, we don't want Paul's name on the record. We don't want success on someone else's coattails. You know, and he's going, oh, what are you going to call him then? And someone said, Apollo C. Vermouth. And Paul says, yeah, I like that.
That was it.
Yes.
He was Apollo.
Talking about artists winding up management time. Yeah. But he said, no, we're thick as thieves.
So it was. I love that because I always thought it would just be Paul was in the studio and just twitching a few knots.
No.
But he was hands on.
Absolutely, he was in there. No, oh, absolutely.
Here comes the sun. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right.
Comes the song.
Yeah.
Flipping over the album. How much joy is there in this song? It's just pure. And George was, he did write quite a few sort of bitter songs, but he shines when he does pure love songs and pure Here Comes the Sun.
I think that's for a lot of people that sort of like sat up most of the night. Oh, yes, Here Comes the Sun.
Oh, we miss him. Do you miss him? You must miss him a lot.
Of course, but I mean, there's a lovely poem by Brian Patton of how many different lengths of time, how long is a man's life, you know, and even though the body's, you know, it's how the children and lovers and everyone remembers and everything, and that's how long life keeps going on and, in, and on until it, you know, it belongs where it belongs.
Mm. Again, going back to that concept, George, one of the scenes I always really gets me every time is where Joe Brown is singing See You In My Dreams at the end, and there's a bit where Darnie Harrison is kind of, because he's a kid at the time, and Eric Clapton just sort of looks over and just puts his arm around him, and Darnie's just sort of like, and you think his dad had died and he was standing there surrounded by world class musicians in front of an audience, Oh, it's...
But I tell you what's more impressive, he didn't miss one chord.
Didn't he not?
Wow. No. No, Danny's a very, very nice man.
Yeah.
Like his dad.
I was so young when I was born, my eyes could not yet see. And by the time my first dawn, somebody holding me.
Crackerbox Palace. I've just got a note here because you're in that, aren't you?
Yes, my acting days.
Very fetching. Very fetching.
Yeah. I do a good pantomime dame. No, but the thing is, there's me dressed as a nanny, if you haven't seen it. And I'm pushing a pram. And inside the pram is George dressed as a schoolboy. And George being George, I'm trying to keep a straight face, and he's pulling faces at me all the time. And it's bloody difficult. You know, and in fact, when he pops up and does his bit to camera, I have to look away. And he's seeing me look away.
Oh, really? I thought you were looking coy.
No, I was about to lose it.
Golden Slumbers, so it's the sort of melody of Golden Slumbers, into Carry That Weight, and then the end with all the guitar solos. So it's a pretty impressive goodbye, isn't it, really, I guess?
Yes. Paul Merton, he's a big Ruttle fan, and he wanted... I used to go down and play piano for them at the Impro thing every now and again, you know. I'm not their first call. There's a lot better people at it than me. But he said, do you think the Ruttles would play at my wedding? I went, oh. Because it's logistically... I thought, wait a minute, why not? The Ruttles should play it. They need a backstory, you know?
Right.
And so we did it. We agreed to do it. And the tragic thing was he knew... The dear lady he was going to marry was terminal with cancer.
Oh.
So it was done anyway, and it was going to be done beautifully, and whatever. And there was a firework display with people who really knew what they're doing. They got laptops and whatnot, and they knew how to time the thing.
Okay, yeah.
And it started off with Thunderclap Newman, Call Out the Instigator, but it ended with, and in the end...
Wow.
And fireworks going, dow, dow, dow. And it's really, you know, lump in the throat stuff.
Yeah.
And it was because it was not public, you know, we were hot ash and some great chunks of timber were falling amongst us. You know? It was, you know, it was a be there moment, yeah. But I mean, now that I can't ever separate that thing now from that that evening where. The music and the fireworks were so synchronized.
Mm.
And the love you take is equal to the love you make. And everybody knew, and everybody... It was a very, very special thing. And, you know, it means that people together can be very special, like at George's thing, or whatever. It's so easy to get hungry.
So many people that have been on here, and so many people I know, the Ruttles. But it's kind of out of context now. It's not just that silly little sketch show that became a film. It's this whole body of music that brings so much happiness and so much joy. And I really hope that you know, I mean, generation, I'm in my 40s, but I know people... Young lads who generational who love your music so much.
No, it is lovely. I mean, what's nice about like last year, and I hope this year will be the same. About 80% of the show, people are singing along with the songs. As a songwriter, there's no greater perk than thinking, "Wow, You know, everybody knows the words, they're doing it. And because we're doing that song another day, yes, in the show. But there's a line in it, you know, another day, I know they say that all the world's a stage. I'll play the fool, but as a rule, I'd rather act my age. Now, my son was in Prague with his wife, and in Wenceslas Square, they've got all these wooden benches, and they've got carved quotes in all the benches. And it's Oscar Wilde, Socrates, you know, it's all this stuff. And there's one of them that says, I'll play the fool, but as a rule, I'd rather act my age, Neil Innes. And I thought, well, that's all right. Thank you very much.
You've made it. You've made it to the benches.
I try and work hard in the words, you know. I mean, I don't. Even when I was writing Raggy Dolls, I thought the stories have got to be about something, you know. And I try, you know. It's not always appreciated, but it doesn't matter, you know. You have to do it. You have to do the best you can.
Yeah. Well, we've got plenty to look forward to with your tour at the moment and the album.
Yeah, I think people are going to be, well, they're going to say, well, you either ignore stuff that people have bothered with, or you sort of you appreciate what's in there. Yes. And the playing is absolutely fabulous.
Yeah,
and there's three trumpet player, trombone player, baritone player. Add up their ages together, they're still younger than me. You know, but they play so beautifully, and with the humour just right for those tracks.
Yeah.
And bang on it on the other tracks where it's more bang on it. Mm-hmm. And a beautiful girl, Sela Mahe, was born in Tonga and grew up in New Zealand and now lives in Brisbane. And there's something about like Alison Krauss or the country singers. They can, you know, pitch that thing in a strong flat singing, they call it. Yeah. And then you got the sort of, you know, the soul sister Detroit Aretha kind of voice. She's a kind of blend.
Wow.
And there's something unique. Yeah. And so it's just she's on it. And was it Malcolm Foster on bass? Used to be with Simple Minds Pretenders. He was on Archaeology. Oh, so he lives in New Zealand, so he just had to hop across. But Warwick Scott, I hadn't worked with before, which was Steve James' favourite guitarist, go-to guitarist, was a delightful man, and he's right there. Mm. And Tony McCall, the drummer, is just always in the pocket. You know, he's a youngster of 42. You
know? Mere whippersnapper.
Yeah. But it did. And my friend Bastian Gombach, who's a classical clarinetist, but he can also play... Well, any bit of plumbing, really.
Oh.
And but, you know, he couldn't come out to Australia, but we sent him a track. Said, Boston, can you put a clarinet on that? Can you put a penny whistle on that? Mm-hmm. And it comes back. It's one take, and it's just wonderful.
Oh, can't wait
just
to hear it.
Just wonderful.
Super.
And so there's that. I mean, you know, the songs are not too shabby, I'm happy to say. But, that's a following wind when you get, you know, people like that all doing it and meaning it and beautifully recorded too.
Brilliant. Can't wait to hear it. Neil Innes, thank you so much for your time.
Chris, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.